That's right. All right, Proverbs 26, 17. And again, just flag me down if this sounds really familiar. We'll go somewhere else. 26, 17. There's kind of an interesting theme of this one and several that follow in regards to entering into chaos and mayhem. Somebody read that. All right, yours kind of flips the order of just the sentence structure. So mine says, like one who takes a dog by the ears. So good idea or bad idea? Grabbing a dog by the ears, right? Why? What's that dog going to do? It's going to fight back, right? So, and once you've grabbed a dog by the ears, now what do? You're fairly committed, would you say? You let go, you're getting bit, so you're in. You're all in, right? You just put all your poker chips on the table, okay? It's the same as one who passes by and meddles with strife not belonging to him. Literally, it's the idea of one who angers himself by meddling with strife or entering into strife not belonging to him. So when you see a situation or a situation is presented to you where someone is, oh, Stephen, you're not going to believe what happened to me yesterday, and that, you know, whatever, and you're like, oh, tell me about it. Right? And you get in and you offer advice and you get all emotionally charged. You're like, man, that guy's an idiot. He shouldn't have done that. Well, now you just grab that dog by the ears. You're in, right? And that person who has originally come to you for whatever, you know, my dumb boyfriend or you can't believe what my mom said or my life group leader this, why are they communicating that more than likely? Why are they saying that to you? They're what? Venting a little bit. What's the purpose of venting? I think we talked about this a little bit. Like, why? What are they trying to do with you? Get you on their side. So you all of a sudden go, oh, you're right. That person is an idiot. Well, now what happens later? So when you leave, that person goes back to the original person and says what? Well, Stephen said that you're an idiot and you should have blah, blah, blah. Well, now you're committed. Now you're fully in. So how do you enter into those situations? How do you empathize? How do you come next to someone? How do you speak truth in the midst of that and not be aloof and like, no, I don't deal with emotions. I don't want to talk to people or whatever, right? Just keep in mind that those situations can be very dangerous. And there's a point in those conversations where it's necessary to be distant in a sense, distant's probably the wrong word, but careful with your emotions and to not respond with emotion, okay? I am guilty of this often when I hear stories, right? Especially when, I think I told you guys a little bit a couple weeks ago that we've got a marriage crisis in our life group right now, and I've heard from the wife, but I still haven't heard from the husband, and I'm getting the Heisman from him anyway, but she for 4 hours was like, bleh! And your inclination is to go, wow, man, if all that's right, then your husband is an idiot. And I want to take a baseball bat to his knee right now. I'm really upset at what he's doing. Well, that may or may not be the full story. And based on humans, it's probably not the full story. It's someone's interpretation. And there's another side. And well, Mike, let me tell you why this went down the way it did. Let me tell you my side of the story. So in the midst of that, Proverbs 18:17, I think, says as much as, the first to plead their case seems right, and that's usually the case, right? You enter in, you hear someone share their side of the story, and you're like, oh, yeah. So be careful in those situations not to commit emotionally or commit verbally to what you think may happen until you've weighed all the evidence, okay? And once you're in, you're in. Now, there's certainly times that you need to jump in, and there's certain people in your life that you need to be that committed to, right? And we started weighing the balance with our life group and said, we need to be in. That's our privilege and responsibility to dive into that marriage, right? That's not Brad's job. That's not some pastor's job at the well. That is my job as a life group leader and as a Christian with the other dudes in the group that we need to enter in. And it's going to be inconvenient. It's going to be a pain in the rear. It's going to cost us time and whatever. But we need to be in because that's the right thing to do, okay? But I have also learned in 37 years that I need to withhold judgment before I hit this guy with a baseball bat. But I still may. So I didn't say that. No, I'm teasing. Only hit it once. So good word. Okay, you look at the rest of this as you kind of look through, scan down just 26, 20, 21, 22, you see a theme here. For lack of wood, the fire goes out, and when there is no whisper, contention quiets down. Where there's no charcoal, or like charcoal on hot embers and wood to a fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. So you're either adding to this issue by throwing gas on a fire or charcoal on a fire or whispers in the midst of already contentious situation, or you can choose kind of not to go that route and calm and not emote and deal with the situation factually and try to enter in a way that is helpful. Okay, so 21, 22, 23 are kind of this idea of gossip and what happens when things are not handled appropriately. Okay, so note the self. There are times in your life that you guys will need to enter into frustratingly difficult situations like that. And then there are times where, you know what, let me offer you some advice. If you were whatever generic person sitting in my office in front of me, this is what I would tell them, okay? Regardless of how emotionally connected I am. And sometimes that's the best way to give advice. I would do this, I would do this, I would do this. Scripture says this. And so that's what I would advise you to do, or something along those lines. Make it a sense? I'm sure like you, if you haven't yet, will have grabbed the dog by the ears as I have one too many times, and you'll learn from the scars on your arm that that is not a really good idea. So learn from mine. Cool. Thoughts, rantings, personal horror stories, or other. This, like, already is hurting my brain and making me emote. I can see.
This one person sends a letter, like a Facebook message, across to this like other person that's mad at the two, and it like exploded exactly like that.
Welcome to interpersonal relationships, right? And they're just always complicated because the web is just not simple, and that's the reality of that. And getting down to the bottom of it and trying to figure out, what's the right way to enter in, and how do I help and not be a hindrance, and, you know, what would God want in this situation? Like, it's just messy. So that's in the more people, the more webs, the more, you know, whatever, it's just, that's the reality of it. So good thing to keep in mind, all right? So yes, we have all been there, and you guys, you know, as you hear Evan share his, you've all been in such a situation, all right? So cool. Be a part of the solution, not the problem. All right. Back to Leviticus. So you guys had fun with Brad, I hope, on Friday. I was in a U-Haul exceeding the speed limit somewhere in New Mexico, I believe. It all went well, yes. So if anybody ever asks, hey, will you move me from Texas to Fresno? Unless they're your parents, the answer is no. There's some advice. Not a proverb, but that is godly wisdom. Yeah, no, it wasn't that bad. So listened to a book on tape and talked to my wife for a lot, which was good, but that was a beatdown. So, but I was a good son. So, all right. I was a good son. I did the right thing. It was the right decision. So we missed you guys dearly. So you guys walked through some Israel stuff, Shabbat. You guys got a good feel for that, and you've got an assignment with that. It's due when? Within a month? I would highly encourage you guys, by the way, to do that together, if Brad probably already said that 8 times. Some of the residents from last year that went to Israel are still Shabbating. So I don't know if you guys are, speaking of webs, interconnected with any of that stuff on Facebook. There's a few that do it every so often. It'd be great to learn from your master senseis that are already going about that and doing it. But there's a bunch of folks that get together and do that based on some of the teachings we had in here and then in Israel. It's pretty cool, okay? And obviously, it's not rocket science, but it's just, you know, it's pushing the pause button for 24 hours with some specificity to it and trying to be intentional about unplugging. So, but you guys will learn to enjoy it. It's a lot of fun, and it's much better done in community, obviously, than, you know, you sitting in your apartment by yourself. So that's not fun, okay? Not the purpose anyway. So cool. So if you guys need some connections there, holla, and I can at least connect the dots with some of you that, if you're interested. If not, go Shabbat with your peeps and have fun. So, and then practical Israel stuff, did you guys cover some of that as well? Cool. Do you feel like you guys got questions answered to some degree, or?
Oh, I had one question. I forgot to ask Brad. Are suitcases, they have to be carry-on size?
No. But we are in 4 different hotels. So just remember, you know, wheels are good in airports and we're moving a lot. So no, it does not have to be carry-on size, but I think it has to be under, what, 55 pounds?
Yeah, I think you said one bag under 50 pounds.
Yeah. So pack light is kind of my philosophy, and we can do laundry while we're there. So in a bathtub, so it's like half clean. So just keep that in mind as well. So the things that you don't mind rewearing that are half dirty, bring less of those. The ones that you want really clean, bring more of those, okay? So is that discreetly said enough? So there you go. So yes, I pack lots of undergarments, okay? And they're dirty shirt, I ain't so worried about. So, but clean underwear and brushing your teeth make you a much better, happier person, okay? So there you go.
I think he gave
yes, the rest of us will also be happy, so right? Hi. Good Lord. I was working out with Brad one morning. We were doing bench press, and I was spotting him, and I was above him like this, and I hadn't brushed my teeth yet. He's like, oh, God, Mike. I'm like, I'm sorry. 5 in the morning, I just forgot. I'm like, I'm sorry, dude. I feel bad. But not that bad. So, enjoy that. Yeah, I'm sorry. There you go. Yeah, my wife went on the trip and forgot her toothbrush, so those hotels that offer you the free toothbrush, we got to finally take part in that. It's not good. Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. So, anyways. No, you're not using mine. All right. Chapter 8. Let's review before we get there. So, tell me what you guys have learned in Leviticus so far. What have we studied since you were outlining this book for me? You teach me. Different types of offerings. Chapters 1 through what? That's not cheating. It's there. You guys are smart enough to put the board there and flip it the right way, then you can cheat.
Yes.
So we're basically all the way through chapter 7, right? We've looked at sacrifices and offerings, okay? So again, what does that tell you? Immediately following the law, God gives 7 chapters on, here are the sacrifices. What's the assumption?
That they're going to break the commandments.
They're going to break the commandments. They need some type of system built into the system that allows them to make restitution for laws broken. So that's the idea. All right. So chapters 1 through 7 are like that. All right. So descriptive, we see obviously the different types. We looked at 5 specifically. Okay. And we'll look at those a little bit more even this morning. But keep these in mind, different purposes for different things, different animals. Some are animals, some obviously like the grain offering are based on flour and oil and more stuff that you have in your kitchen, less stuff that you have in your backyard. Okay, so different things, different purposes. Does that say sexy beast?
I just saw that right now.
I'm like, it remotely looks like my handwriting too, so I'm like, I did not write that.
That is your handwriting.
You guys are quickly becoming my least favorite group. That's funny. I don't care what you say. You guys get bonus points on the exam for that. I will give you a quarter of a point. All right, so let's pick up in chapter 8. Different feel here, okay? So I just want you to notice where we're headed, okay? So 1 through 7 had a certain theme, okay? 8's going to change. So let's pick up 8:1.
Spoke to Moses, saying, "Take Aaron and his sons with him, and the garments and the anointing oil, and the bowl of the sin offering, and the 2 rams, the basket of unleavened bread, and assemble all the congregation at the entrance of the tent of meeting."
All right, so now we're back to kind of like historical narrative. So we got Aaron, we got his sons, we got sin offerings, we got rams, we've got certain animals, and they're going where? Verse 3.
Tabernacle,
right? Tent of meeting, tabernacle, same thing, okay? Moses did, verse 4, just as what God had said. And then in verse 6, Moses had Aaron and his sons come near and wash them with water. Okay, so first thing, they're going to get washed. We've talked a little bit about this before, and we'll see it kind of as a theme throughout. They get washed, and then 7, they get dressed. Linen tunic is put on them, girded with the sash. So what is all this stuff? The ephod, the robe, what are these things? We did 8? You're right.
We did 9.
We did 9.
Yes, you're liars. All of that? No, he didn't. He taught 10?
Yeah,
because
he's like, Michael may teach 10. I was like, yeah, I'll teach 10. So we did 10, then we talked about Israel.
We skipped 9. And then we talked about Israel. Yeah. We skipped 9.
He taught Nadab and Abihu. Yeah.
Maybe.
Jerk.
He did a really kind of job, didn't he?
That does. Yes, our senior teaching pastor, I'm sure, did a horrible job teaching the Bible. I doubt that. He calls me the other day. So we're talking. He's like, hey, I'm thinking about this, that, and the other thing, and maybe teaching this and that. And he's like, where are you in Leviticus? And I don't want to tell him because I'm like, this is my favorite part. I really like Nadab and Abihu. So I'm like, So I tell him and thinking he's not going to want to teach that. He's like, well, maybe I'll just pick up there. And he's like, well, maybe I'll do this and maybe I'll do that. And that's Brad, right? He can sit down and teach whatever he wants to whenever he wants to because he's... So, all right. So you guys got all this. Thank you for speaking up. All right. So... You got 10, you got the Nadab and Abihu picture. So, two crispy critters, all that. Dang it. No, I'm good. I'm good. I'm going to get over my insecurity.
It was really
short. It was short. Let's review it. How about that? Because I do want you guys to see a couple big picture things. So, theme of it, what's going on with these two guys, Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron? What was thrown out there in terms of what could be going on as to why God just absolutely slew these guys?
We talked a little bit about the relation to in Acts, the story of Ananias and Sapphira.
Good.
In the beginning of the church and now in the beginning of their sacrificial system, God just like setting the tone.
Yeah.
Right off the bat.
Right. So he takes this very seriously, right? And you do see this, hey, first person to go. In certain systems, man, you get to reap some consequences that are significant. So they did something to merit death, which is there's not a whole lot worse than that, I would suppose. So I can't think of anything offhand. What was their sin?
They offered
unauthorized fire on the altar, okay? There is a whole chapter in Exodus dedicated to what is supposed to be offered in that situation, okay? So literally, it's like baking a cake, and God's like, here's the recipe. And I don't know if we covered it or not in that detail, but the idea was, this is mine. Yeah, we talked about that. Like, you can't even, a perfumer cannot make this recipe. This is my own. This is how the inside of the tabernacle is to smell. These are my recipe, right? And they didn't do that. Maybe. That's an option, okay? So they offered unauthorized fire, which means they got the recipe wrong and they forgot to add whatever or added this carelessly and came up with some other random concoction and God said no. So maybe God warranted death in God's eyes. I don't know. What other options?
We talked about the fact that shortly after that, God told Moses, not to be drunk when presenting offerings. And
yeah. Can you imagine, right? Can you imagine being the first priest and having had a couple too many glasses of vino on your way in and having a very haphazard attitude in your approach to God, right? That devastating. So I think that's probably, I think it's a, when I've taught this text before, that's where I've gone with it. So I think that they were probably intoxicated or at least had been drinking enough to the point where it was like, man, you should go in with a reverent fear of God and shouldn't have even been in that state at all, whether depending on what degree of drinking they had done. Okay, I think both of those are decent possibilities. One seems a little harsh, but God's not messing around. It's like, listen, this is how you approach me, and I'm not to be approached casually or haphazardly or however you feel like you should. Like, I set the rules. You come to me how I say you come to me. Okay, so pretty significant. So good. I think that's good that you guys see that. Paint a picture for me and I think this is good, especially for those of you guys that have grown up in the church, okay? I didn't. I grew up Christmas, Easter, and, said hi and bye to the pastor on my way in and way out twice a year and, right, had been around things. But a lot of you guys, man, you came out of the womb with a Bible and, we're leading people to Christ in preschool and it's great, right? What's the learning lesson from a Nadab and an Abihu for those of you that, man, have grown up around the things of God your whole life? Yeah. Is it easy to treat the things of God as casual? It's like, man, I've been there, done that. Like, I've been doing this my whole life. I don't remember not being a Christian. There's a danger in that for the things that are holy to become just everyday and mundane, and yeah, that's what I do, and I go to church, and I worship, and I pray, and I have a quiet time, or whatever, and that's just kind of my life, and it just gets boring, right? It's part of the fun, by the way, of being around new Christians that have that zeal and that sparkle in their eye, and everything's new, and they have no idea who Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are, and you're like, please, I flannel graph them, you know, all day long, whatever, right? I know all the stories, I know all the right answers, I can spank all of you in Bible trivia, I know it all. But that's the fun and the excitement when people are like, it's Job? No, Job. Oh, right? And you're, all that's new, okay? So Nadab and Abihu are a great example of the people that like, yeah, I got drugged in church my whole life, and I did that, and I've been around the things of God, and my dad's the high priest, and whoop-de-doo, you know, I'm better than you, and I get to wear all these cool garments, and look at me. There's a danger in that. So good message for you guys teaching in the future to, you know, chapel services or Christian kids. You know, in the valley, this is the Bible Belt of California. You know, we have a lot of these type of people around us that are have been overexposed, and they're burnt out, and they're tired of, you know, hypocrisy and, you know, what have you. So it's a good message for a lot of the folks that we tend to deal with in our geographical circles, okay? So 8, 9, and 10, Nadab and Abihu, you know, we've built the tabernacle. We go to launch it for the first time. It goes horribly wrong, and now we've got issues, okay? We're going to look at 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15, okay? But before we do, look at 16, and I just want you guys to keep this in mind as we venture into 16. Okay? I just want to start it, okay, but not finish it yet, okay? 16:1, read that. Okay, so I want you to keep this in mind. What we're about to read right now, 11 through 15, is a parenthesis, okay? 16 is the next, it's the chronological anchor. So immediately after the death of his two sons, chapter 16 comes, and God speaks to Moses, and he's going to say, great, here's what, or Aaron rather, here's what you need to do now, okay? So let's wait on that, but I just want you to see chronologically, these are right next to each other, okay? And it's going to be important to see kind of how those work together, all right? So 1 through 7, offerings. 8 through 10. Historical narrative. Give me theme. What's going on? What are we talking about? You had to step back and say, what are those chapters about? What are they? Yeah, okay. So there's a priesthood theme to it for sure. What else is going on? Where are they kickstarting for the very first time? Worship in where? Worship in the tabernacle. Tabernacle, right? We've never used this thing before. Like, this is first time, okay? And how'd it go? Yeah, not so good. Okay, so 8 through 10, I would communicate something about priests, something about the tabernacle, something about first time, okay? And, you know, that's the big picture there, okay? 11, you're going to feel now another swing, okay? Chapter 11, verse 1, let's pick up there.
All
right, so different feel, okay? So God is about to go into a dissertation in all of chapter 11 about food they can eat and food they can't eat, okay? Clean versus unclean, okay? So let's keep going. Let's see what's on the menu for an Israelite.
Whatever parts the hoof and is cloven-footed and chews the cud among the animals, you may eat.
All right, so there's the big picture category of how God is determining what is clean and what is unclean, okay? If it divides the hoof, okay, so if it has literally a split hoof, right, that's a piece of the requirement. If it chews the cud, okay, chews the cud in our terminology would probably be a little bit different. They're a little bit looser there, but like a cow who repeatedly chews its food, swallows it, comes back up, chews it, okay, it's the idea that it's thorough. It's not some scavenger bird or whatever that it eats meat and swallows. You know, it's that's kind of the picture. It seems to be why God would have chosen that division. So split hooves, choose the cut among those animals you may eat. Okay, so that's the big picture category. And then there's going to be some exceptions to that rule. Okay, 4.
Nevertheless, among these that chew the cud or part the hoof, you shall not eat these. The king camel because it chews the cud but does not part the hoof is unclean to you. And the rock badger because it chews the cud but does not part the hoof is unclean to you. And the hare because it chews the cud but does not part the hoof is unclean to you. And the pig because it parts the hoof and is cloven footed but does not chew the cud is unclean to you. You shall not eat any of their flesh and you shall not touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you.
All right, so those are the exceptions, okay? Pigs, so again, no pork, no bacon, no pig products at all. Nothing that comes from a pig can be eaten by an Israelite. Rabbits are out. The saffron or the rock badger, right? We did a proverb on that one. It's like, I don't know what that is, okay? So, but they can eat that anyway, so it doesn't matter. Right? And that's the list of stuff, okay? So no camels. Those are, they've got a pad on the bottom of their foot. Doesn't divide, but they chew the cud, okay? So, again, weird, or I guess maybe different for us interpretations of what would be clean and unclean, but these are the land animals that they can eat, okay? So cows, deer, ibex, what else is in that list? Those are the type of things that they are okay to eat, okay? That's on their diet, okay? So 1 through 8 is essentially about the land animals that they're allowed to eat, okay? So, and the exceptions to the rule. So it's not a long list, okay? It's there's a lot more exceptions than there are things that they can eat, okay? So verse 9 through 12, we're going to look at animals in the water that they can eat, okay? Read 9 and following.
Regard them as detestable. You shall not eat any of their flesh, and you shall detest their carcasses. Everything in the waters that does not have fins and scales is detestable.
All right, so give me an example. What's got fins and scales that you can eat? Fish, right? Okay, so we're going to go to the Sea of Galilee. We're going to eat a fish called the St. Peter's fish. Fins and scales, and it's what was commonly fished, is one of the two major fishing fish in Sea of Galilee, okay? That's what they would have caught when Peter's talking about casting his nets overboard. That would have been a common catch, okay? They're still there today. We're going to eat them. Fins and scales, green light, okay? Give me an example of not fins and scales that lives in the water that you cannot eat.
Crab.
Squid. Eels, right? Slimy things, right? Whatever, okay? Those are off limits, okay? They shall be abhorrent to you. Okay, I mean, some strong language. Like, these are the fish you can eat. So, you want a nice sea bass? Great, knock yourself out. You want some tilapia? You want some salmon? Go for it. Okay. You want some, you know, electric eel? No dice. Okay. We're seeing this idea of clean, unclean. Okay. What does that mean? What do those categories mean for a Jew?
I mean, medically speaking, like for instance, with pigs, I know there's a lot of things that could have been carried by
yep.
a pig. Is that where it's going?
The words in the Hebrew, as far as I know, don't. But there is a much bigger meaning behind just, like, that's a dirty, filthy animal, you know, like don't eat a vulture just because they're nasty, as opposed to, right? What's the bigger connection for a Jew? When we're talking clean or unclean, 1 through 7 offerings, 8 through 10 the tabernacle, how do you have to approach God? Clean. What does it mean to be clean? I.e. chapters 1 through 7. Free from sin. Right? So if you eat an animal that's unclean, you are then unclean, and you cannot what?
Approach God.
Can you go worship in the tabernacle? No. So man, if there's a worship service that night, if there's an offering from your family, if you're about to participate in Passover, and you're unclean. God gives rules as to how long you're unclean, what certain things do that make you unclean, how long you have to do whatever, what you need to do to enter cleanliness again. Okay, so this isn't just about like food and those things. It's about a worship of God. What else? And we'll read it this morning, but when you're unclean, what happened in terms of like your interaction with people?
Couldn't really interact.
No, can't interact. How do they live in Israel? They all have like their own rooms and big houses and Do you live like you did in South America? It's extended family, living together, close quarters. And if you're unclean and you touch a person or have a whatever, a discharge on your skin or what have you, and you touch another person, what happens to that other person? They're unclean. So when you're unclean, it's a big deal. It removes you from a worship of God, and it also removes you from your community. You're often put outside the camp. We're going to look at that this morning. But it's a big deal. This isn't just like, no, don't eat that. It's got repercussions. So you need to follow these things, okay? There's a reason behind why God's doing this, and we'll see that here in a second. But it isn't just related to a diet. It's related to worship of God. It's related to your worship or your interaction with man and your fellow humans, okay? So, make sense? So this is these categories are a big deal, okay? So just keep that in mind, all right? Absolutely. These are kosher foods. These are okay, right? So kosher hot dogs. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means it's made out of some type of beef product that's okay because I can't have anything that came from a pig. But if you make a turkey burger or a turkey dog, well, okay, I can do that, right? That's on the okay list, okay? So Jews today that are still following this, which in a day and age where we no longer have a temple to worship in, the Jews will adhere to these laws is even more important because that's the only way they can continue to obey God. They see these and go, great, then I'm going to follow these to the letter because we no longer have a temple. Okay, so these are even, in some ways, to a very Orthodox Jew, more important today than they even were back then, if that makes sense. Okay, so, all right. Yeah, some of it is based on disease. So God, you're going to see, is he keeps a very clean people, right? In terms of their homes, they have to clean their homes a certain way and that sort of thing. But no, like it wasn't like that animal's evil and that animal's good. But at least the appearance from divides a hoof and chews the cud was the idea that these are cleaner animals. So yeah, that's kind of the idea, okay?
Because, I mean, in Acts, you know, when Peter has that interaction, God tells him that not to call unclean, he's clean. He gives the interaction of animals there. Could this be more just, or a part of it being
right.
God just wanting to separate his people again from the nations around them to just another example of, these are my people, these are things they don't do that the nations around them.
Absolutely, and that's very well said, and that's going to be a theme of Israel. You're my people, and you live distinct, you live different. And just because everyone else is eating pigs, you don't get to.
Also, like, all this stuff that happens to you now makes them constantly work on their faith. You're not just going to sit there and be like, lukewarm.
Yeah.
You're either in
or
you're out.
Right, you're either moving towards God or away. There's no...
There's like total accountability, too, because now everyone knows you're playing around.
Yeah, exactly. And it's public, right? You're outside the camp, or you're getting examined by a priest, or you're having to offer whatever sacrifice because you ate and you can't enter back into fellowship for a day, right? It's a big deal. So yeah, and Jared, to get back to your point, a lot of that is you're going to live distinct. Why? Because I want you to live distinct, and they eat pigs, so you're not going to. And sometimes it's as simple as that, okay? So maybe these things were offered in pagan sacrifices, and God said, I don't want you to have anything to do with that animal because of that, or what have you, okay? So we'll see a lot of that, all right? So 9 through 12, you get waterborne stuff. 13 through 23 is all flying things. Okay, so 13 through 19 is birds. And you can imagine why they can't eat some of these. 13, moreover, you shall detest among the birds. They are abhorrent, not to be eaten. The eagle, the vulture, the buzzard. Like, I don't know who's going to eat a buzzard. You know, that's filthy animals. Bearded vulture. That's funny. I don't know if I told you guys this story. I went deer hunting in seminary, and if you've ever field dressed a deer, you take out what you want, you leave the carcass there, and then you start seeing these vultures that are they're literally hovering, and they eat everything. And you're like, man, you guys are filthy animals. So minus the intestines, it's the only thing that those animals won't eat. But I mean, you talk about picking a carcass clean. They're abhorrent animals. So obviously, as you look at something like that, you go, those are nasty birds, and you don't want any part of that, right? They literally are dirty birds, okay? So part of that was for disease stuff. So you look at vultures and stuff that feed on rotting carcass and how dead is dead. Well, you know, for us, we can eat one thing, but for them, it's like, yeah, it's 2 weeks dead. That's fine. But, you know, so I don't know what kind of stomach they got, but we don't want that stomach in our stomach, right? Okay. So you see, again, a list of things that they can and can't eat. Okay. 20 winged insects. Okay. That things that they could and couldn't eat. Okay. You get a whole list there. Okay. So 24. This is interesting. It's not just eating, but read this.
And by these you shall become unclean. Whoever touches their carcass shall be unclean until the evening. And whoever carries any part of their carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening.
So you pass by an animal unsuspectingly that's dead and touch it. Just touch it. What happens? Unclean. Dang it, right? Now I'm 24 hours out of fellowship. I've got to walk through whatever sacrifice to get me right with God. It is, right? Exactly, right? In most dead carcasses, other than clean animals, for the purpose of preparing them to eat, are unclean. So your family dog dies, you can't eat it. It's an unclean animal. How do you dispose of it? Crud, I got to be unclean to do that, or whatever. So death was a big deal. And death in close quarters, when you're dealing with people all the time, man, it's an inconvenience for everybody. So, man, if you sin, you're potentially going to make me sin or become unclean or what have you, okay? So,
quick question.
Yep.
I just kind of had a light bulb moment. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, uh-huh. Would that be the reason that they would cross the other side of the road and pass by?
Because
the guy who fell among the robbers could be seen as unclean?
I don't think so. Not in that case. Because a dead human, well, it would make you unclean to deal with it, yes. So certainly, that's probably a minor theme in that story, though. But yeah, no, it certainly would have, because that would have been a dead body, and there's a whole deal in Numbers, we'll get to it, about how you cleanse yourself from a human dead body. So.
Like in regards to death, too, like when they had to clean the body, when they had to touch the dead body, would that be considered an intentional or unintentional?
It's necessary, so it's understood, but you're still unclean. So it's not like, it's just like, well, this is what has to be done, and I'm going to become unclean as a result of that. So think through now the story of Samson, right? Dead lion on the side of the road. This guy's got, he's underneath the Nazarite vow, so his adherence to the law is like up a few notches like Paul's was. He sees a dead lion on the side of the road. What does he do? Didn't any of you guys go to Sunday school? He sticks his hand in it and takes honey from out of this line and eats it, right? This guy was like above and beyond in terms of pursuing the law. So did he know, A, that's an unclean animal, B, it's dead. So what's going to happen when I stick my hand in it? I'm unclean. So what is his heart towards the things of God? I care less. I want to eat. I'm hungry. Samson is a beautiful picture of a guy that just is motivated by the flesh, okay? And we'll learn about him in Israel and as we walk through, obviously, our Old Testament, okay? So, you guys getting a theme of 11? Foods that are clean and unclean, animals that are on the land, water, flying insects. 26 through 31 is more unclean animals, things you can't eat, okay? So the rest of this chapter is all about food issues that make you clean and unclean, okay? 46 and 47 of chapter 11 are kind of a theme of chapter 11, okay? So here's God's, oh, by the way, okay, or in summary, 46 and 47.
This is the law about beast and bird and every living creature that moves throughout the waters and every creature that swarms on the ground, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, and between the living creature that may be eaten and the living creature that may not be eaten.
God's choosing to make distinction between the clean and the unclean. He's drawing the categories, and that's what he's doing for Israel. Okay, so 47 verses on food you can eat, food you can't eat, right? I mean, Battle of David and Goliath, we get two verses on the battle. We get 47 on what food they can and can't eat. Things that we don't even, what is a seraphim or a rock badger? Like, I have no idea. But God thought it was that important that he gave us a long chapter on eat this, don't eat this, okay? So again, law of proportion, important? Yeah, okay? So, 11, food, okay? 12.
The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if a woman conceives and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean 7 days. as at that time of her menstruation, she shall be unclean.
Okay, so 12, what are we getting into? Childbirth, okay? So what happens when you have a kid for a woman? You're unclean, okay? Now, it's not the kid that makes you unclean. Childbirth obviously is a gift. Kids are a gift. God sees that all through Scripture, okay? Not to be graphic, but for any of you that have been a part of childbirth, it is a unclean process, okay? Can we just leave it at that? So there are things that happen. Obviously, there's lots of fluids that are involved. We're going to see that continue, that theme of bodily fluids in 13 and 14, and that's part of it, okay? So for a woman, a couple things you just see and note here that we haven't seen earlier. She is unclean 7 days, okay, for having a male child, as in the days of her menstruation. So what does that tell you about a woman in terms of her menstruation? She's unclean. During her entire menstrual cycle, a woman is unclean, okay? So, sorry, gals, but you're not going to temple, you're not going to the tabernacle, you're not worshiping, you're unclean and cannot participate in, you know, sorry, guys, I can't go to life group tonight. Why not? It's like, okay. You know, it's like, and can you imagine back, I mean, not to be graphic, but man, technology is a very nice thing, right? Can you imagine living in that day and age with that many people and that many close quarters and just not having the privacy and the products available to you that we do today, okay? Just you need to think about it a little bit. It's just different, right? And it would have been very obvious and open to everybody, right? That's a very private thing in our society. We don't talk about that, except for at residency at 6 in the morning. And it's even more awkward. But that's the reality of it, right? And it's just, it would have been different and a pain, okay? So that made you unclean. So for a male child, 7 days, okay? And then you get a little note here on verse 3 that we've seen before with Moses. On the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised, okay? So every male child, on the 8th day, they get circumcised. That's the procedure, okay? Verse 4, then she shall remain in the blood of her purification for 33 days. She shall not touch any consecrated thing, nor enter the sanctuary until the days of her purification are completed. So 7 days for a male, plus an additional 33, you're unclean. So male child, how many days are you unclean? 40. Total, 40. 7 plus 33, okay? So you have a male kid, 7 plus 33, 40 days, no worship. So we're talking a month and a week now. You're out of fellowship with God and out of that routine and that interaction. Okay? Verse 5.
But if she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean 2 weeks as in her menstruation, and she shall continue in the blood of her purifying for 66 days.
Huh. So you have a female child. How long are you unclean? 2 weeks and... So 14 plus 66, 80. What's up with that? 40 days for a male, 80 for a female. Why?
Because a female also will have this cycle.
That is a hypothesis, absolutely. So maybe because later in life, a woman's going to have the same type of menstrual cycle later, childbirth, all the things that make her unclean. At the end of the day, we have no idea, okay? My joke is that because males are better than females, and that's why, but I'm teasing.
So
no idea. So, yeah, so funny. So, we don't know. So, for whatever reason, the female length of uncleanliness is longer, okay? So, food makes you unclean. Chapter 12, what else makes you unclean?
Women,
yeah, that's right, Sonny. I heard that from the mouth of a woman. Ben, good job not speaking right there. Childbirth, right? Childbirth makes you unclean, okay?
So, what if you die while you're unclean, then what would happen to you? Like,
you're
considered, like, boom, you're out of heaven?
No, you're still good. You just can't, yeah, no. You're in, as a Jew, you just die unclean. So it's not like, this isn't salvific, non-salvific type stuff. I don't know. It 40 days is the number of completion. Testing. Sorry. Take that back. Seven's testing. 40 is
seven.
Sorry. Find your brain. Yeah, it's the number of testing. I don't think so there, but I don't know. Some Jews can be, there's a whole mystic side of Jews. What did Madonna get all into a number of years ago, that wacky religion? You guys remember that?
Oh, the
Kabbalah?
Yeah.
Kabbalah. That is Jewish mysticism. Numbers and interpretation and what's in the text that's not really in the text. That's Kabbalah. So there's a certain piece of it. You're like, no, that's legit, right? Some of that stuff, you know, you can take it too far. So I don't know. Not that I've heard in this text, okay? So food, unclean and clean. Menstruation and childbirth makes you clean or unclean, okay?
So while the woman is unclean, the man obviously would want to touch the woman.
Correct.
Does it make you pay for like the woman's health after she's gave birth?
And you see a lot of that, right? That's good for a woman, right? To be separated. You know, she's in a, her body's worn down, so let's not put her in the midst of, you know, lots of people, keep her separated. A lot of these are going to be for the sake of, let's not infect anyone else, and let's make sure you get better, right? So, yes. No, she can still take care of the baby. I think the baby's obviously not participating in worship, so no, I think that's part of the process, but yeah, so no, it's not like, here, Dad, I'm out for 80 days. Give me my bonbons and Oprah. Ding, 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 ding. I need a Kleenex, honey. So, I don't think so. All right, let's keep going. We got to get to 16 today, okay? 13, interesting, okay? What does your chapter heading say?
Leprosy.
Leprosy, interesting, okay? 13:1, Moses and Aaron, when a man has a scab or a swelling on a scab or a bright spot, and it becomes an infection of leprosy, the skin of the body, then he shall be brought to Aaron the priest and the sons, and blah, 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 blah. We'll get into this, okay? Chapter 13 is all about infectious skin diseases. The word leprosy is used here, okay? When we think leprosy, we think of the actual disease called Hansen's disease, okay, with an E, H-A-N-S-E-N. That is modern-day leprosy. It seems that this chapter has a much bigger context than just that individual disease. This is kind of all diseases that would have resulted in skin-borne ailments, right? So chickenpox, boils, whatever diseases you get that show themselves on the skin. Hey, I got poison ivy, I was cutting wood and whatever. Okay, you've got issues, you know. So anything that would have resulted in some type of resulting rash, scab, pus, ooziness on the skin, okay, who's hungry, that's going to show up in this chapter, okay? So here's how it works, okay? You've got some ailment on your skin. You're like, huh, I didn't cut myself. That's weird. I don't know what that is, okay? Your job, okay, was to go to verse 3, read that.
The priest shall examine the diseased area on the skin of his body. And if the hair in the diseased area has turned white and the disease appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it is a case of leprous disease. When the priest has examined him, he shall pronounce him unclean.
Okay, so you go to who? The priest. And what does he do? He looks at it. And then what does he determine? Clean or unclean, okay? No, you're good. No, you just, that's a burn from the stove, or maybe not, you know, whatever. That's fine, you're good. Or, no, unclean, okay? I pronounce you unclean, okay? He's not a doctor, but he's making a determination based on, so he's not treating it, he's just saying, I am putting you in one of the two camps. That's the job of Moses, Aaron, and the two remaining sons, Eleazar and Ithamar, okay? That's their job, okay? This whole chapter is about how each process works, okay? So, hey, you've got an appearance on your skin. He makes a determination. Verse 4, he says, hey, you know what? You're outside of the camp 7 days. On the seventh day, you can come back in. He'll re-examine it. And if it's gone, okay, you're good. So you're isolated. You go get time to heal and come back into the camp. If it's gotten worse, then you're still isolated, and that's kind of the idea, okay? Why would you take somebody with an infectious skin disease and isolate them from everyone else? Is God not brilliant, right? Part of this is for the health of the people. Well, I don't know what that is. Is it leprosy? Is it a virus? Is it some random genetic deal that isn't communicable, but we don't know? So leave the camp. You know, you're sneezing, you're out of here, right? None of us want your fungi or your, you know, I don't want to be throwing up tomorrow because we all get the flu. That's what God's doing. How do they live? Man, it's like tight, right? You got to... literally, millions of people camping in the wilderness, constant interaction. They're not spread out. They're all together. So, I mean, if one person gets some random skin ailment, what happens? It spreads like wildfire. So you're outside the camp, okay? So this keeps Israel clean. Okay? Look how long chapter 13 is. 59 verses on if you have this, if you have that, you go to the priest for this, and here's what he says about that. If there's a hair that's growing out of this deal that's this color, then you do this. If it's not this, you're like, holy cow, are you kidding me? Okay? And it goes from stuff that's on your arm, to stuff that's on your head, to stuff that's on your face, to stuff that, I mean, it's detailed, okay, in how to do that, and all the things that go on, okay? So, chapter 11, what's that about? Animals, that make you what? Clean or unclean. Chapter 12, childbirth and menstruation, okay? Things that make you clean or unclean. Chapter 13, various skin ailments that make you clean or unclean, okay? That's it. Chapter 14 and 15 are all about how you get cured from these. Look how long these chapters are. 57 verses in chapter 14, and in chapter 15, 33. This is all about, hey, the priest has pronounced you clean. Disease has healed itself. You're good. Here's how you come back into fellowship, okay? All the offerings, all the things you had to do, okay? It was this long, elaborate, detailed issue of birds that had to be sacrificed or certain different types of offerings. This is the first offering, by the way, in 14 where you see birds as the specific sacrifice as opposed to like, oh, you're poor, here's the backup sacrifice type deal. There's some imagery here in 14 that is unique to this chapter in chapter 16 that I want to wait and touch on in chapter 16, okay? So, but this is the whole cure, okay? Lengthy. It's all about getting right with God and getting back into, you know, fellowship with people, okay? What was the thing that I wanted to mention? Leprosy, scabs. So fun, right? Who doesn't want to talk about this at this hour of the morning? Is it 14? Ah, 15, okay? This is kind of bodily discharges, okay? So 14 is the cleansing part. 15 is kind of some of both. But it's just like any type of discharge from your body would make you unclean, okay? So obviously for a woman, that's menstruation. Anything that you touch would have been unclean. Not to be graphic, but sex between a husband and wife made you unclean. Okay, so if you're getting ready to go to worship, you've got to think about those things. There's a period where God says, no, no relations. Like, you're going to think and concentrate on me, and that makes you unclean. So it's not a bad thing. God's not saying sex is evil or sex is wrong, but it made you unclean for a period of time, and then you got back into fellowship with God. Okay, so just interesting on the things that were appropriate or inappropriate at certain periods. Okay, and then there were, again, things that you had to use to make you clean again. Okay, so 1 through 7, offerings. 8 through 10, priesthood, tabernacle, okay? 11 through 15, clean, unclean, things that make you clean, unclean, right? So, how are you feeling right now as a Jew? Like, what are you utterly convinced of at this point?
Always going to be sacrificed.
Why? A little bit, right? It's a pain. I'm going to be unclean all the time. And that's just with things I'm aware of, right? We had a whole offering for unintentional sin. Like, oops, I didn't even know I did that, right? I didn't know I offended you. Or that sin never hit my radar. Or I didn't know that I brushed by that dead whatever and touched it. I didn't even know it was there. But now I'm unclean. I didn't even know I'm unclean, right? But as a Jew, you are utterly convinced that at some point in great frequency, you are going to be unclean. You cannot interact with people, and you cannot interact with God, which is a really big deal if you're a Jew, right? So, chapter 16, okay? This is slightly big, okay? Chapter 16. Let's pick up 16:1, which we already read, and let's talk about this, okay? So, immediately following the death of Nadab and Abihu, God says to Aaron, okay, and his two sons, verse 2, tell your brother Aaron that he shall not enter at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat which is on the ark, or he will die, for I will appear in a cloud over the mercy seat. Okay? So what is God telling Moses, or what is Moses revealing to Aaron regarding verse 2? Where is he telling him he's going to go? This is Holy of Holies, okay? This is not entrance to the tabernacle. There's the altar, the bronze laver, and all the things that are outside. This is inside the inner veil, into the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat, okay? He says, hey, you don't get to go all the time, okay? God says, I will set a time for you to do that. Turn real quick to chapter 23, okay? This is a elaboration on this chapter, okay? My chapter heading on 23 says laws concerning the festivals. You guys remember the chart I gave you in Exodus and I walked you guys through the feast and festival schedule? Here it is again. Chapter 23 is that schedule laid out, okay? 3:1-3. 3 in the spring, okay, starts with Passover, then unleavened bread and first fruits. Those are your spring festivals that all revolve around the harvest, okay? Then first fruits is kind of the one that's stuck in the middle. So 3, and then, I'm sorry, Pentecost is the one that's stuck in the middle, 50 days after Passover. And then you have your 3 fall feasts, okay? It starts with trumpets, okay? Rosh Hashanah, which we're going to look at here in just a second. Yom Kippur, which is chapter 16, which means, Yom Kippur. What does Yom mean way back, Genesis 1? A day. So Yom means day. Kippur means to cover, okay? So chapter 16 is about the day of covering, okay? Talk about what that means here in a sec. And then Sukkot, or booths or tabernacles, is a reminder of how God provided for Israel in the wilderness and how they lived in pop-up tents during this period, okay? And how God provided for them for 40 years, okay? That's the feast and festival schedule, all right? So chapter 23, look at 23:23. This is Rosh Hashanah, okay? This is what precedes Yom Kippur, or the day of covering, okay? So read this.
And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall observe a day of solemn rest, a memorial proclaimed with blasts of trumpets, a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work, and you shall present a food offering to the Lord.
Okay, so notice here, what time are we talking about? Look at 27, or 24 rather. Seventh month, what day? Okay, this is Tishri, I believe. Okay, not of huge importance, but it's the first day of the month, okay? 27, on exactly the 10th day of the seventh month, here comes Yom Kippur, okay? So these two deals are separated by how many days? First to the 10th, right? So you start on the first, and then to the 10th, so Rosh Hashanah, Tishri 1, and then Yom Kippur starts on the 10th of Tishri, okay? The 7th month, 10th day, okay? Now, let me walk you through a bit of what's going on, okay? This is the Jewish New Year, okay? Not in the sense of ball drops, party, kiss somebody. This is the spiritual side of our New Year, okay? What do I mean by that? Aside from the mass drinking and crazy parties that happen on New Year's, what is the spiritual side of New Year's for us? It's a do-over. It's a reset button. What are we all thinking about? Even pagans, what are they thinking about on New Year's? Resolutions. What should I do different this year? So what are you doing? What are you thinking about?
Thinking about the past.
Yeah, what was my last year like? What did I do? What were the things that I set out to do and I didn't do? What do I like about my life that I need to continue? So you're what? You're reflecting. And you're thinking, So you're examining yourself. You're thinking about, what was my past like, okay? And then what are you doing? You're changing. You're thinking forward of, man, what am I going to do differently? What goals am I going to have? What resolutions am I going to set? That is Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, okay? And how big a deal is this? Look at 24. You will stop. You will do no work. It is a holy convocation for you. You're going to rest. So mandatory quiet time for everybody. Stop what you're doing. Don't go to work. Think. Reflect. Okay? It's not elaborate in the text, but history would tell us, based on how Jews practiced this, that it's not just for a day. It's for 10. So from the blowing of the shofar, the trumpet that's mentioned here in chapter 23, verse 24, until Yom Kippur, 10 days you would rest and think and not do work and reflect and think purposefully about your life, okay? Most of the celebrations, by the way, in Israel are very communal and they're very celebratory. Passover, you're eating with your family and you're killing a lamb and you're doing all this stuff together. This one's different. It's not a party. It's calm. It's reflective. You're thinking about your sin. You're thinking about, what are the things that I've done that I didn't want to do? What does my life look like, right? And it's not celebratory in nature, okay? And it's not with other people. It's very individual, okay? It's one of the few festivals that's not communal. It's private. You're thinking about my relationship with God. Specifically, where did I err? Where did I blow it? Where did I sin? What are the things that I know of that I've been offering sacrifices for at the very least? And what did I do wrong? Okay? That gets you into the Day of Atonement. Let's read a little bit about this, continuing in chapter 23. Okay? So we see that it's 10 days later, okay? Verse 27. It shall be as well a holy convocation for you. You shall humble your souls and present an offering by fire to the Lord. 28, neither shall you do any work on that same day, for if it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement on your behalf before the Lord. Okay, 29, keep reading.
For whoever is not afflicted on that very day shall be cut off from his people. And whoever does any work on that very day, that person I will destroy from among his people.
So how serious is God about this? Okay, we've heard that euphemism before, to be cut off. What does that mean? I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. God says, that's, if you don't take this seriously, I'm going to kill you, okay? Any person that does any work on that day, they're going to die, okay? So, fairly big deal that God's setting the table here. In fact, Jews would not just fast and not do work on this day for 24 hours, they would extend it to 25, just to make good and sure that an hour before sundown, they shut it down and made sure that they didn't somehow bleed their work into the next day, and then they would wait till after sunset for sure, the next day when the sun went down, before they continued into work or eating or whatever, okay? So for sure, you're fasting, okay? Based on everything else that we just read, what else are you abstaining from? On the Day of Atonement. Husbands and wives, what are you not doing? Because you want to come into this day clean, right? You're not eating unclean animals. You're not participating in anything 11 through 15 that would make you unclean because you can't participate in this day, right? It's a big deal. So you're abstaining from a lot of stuff, okay? Definitely fasting. You're praying. You're processing. You guys get a feel for what this day feels like? Okay, back to 16. Just want to set the stage for what's happening and what they're feeling, okay? So this day is going to revolve around Aaron, okay? And him being the mediator between you and God, okay? Verse 3, Aaron shall enter the holy place with this, with a bull for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. Okay? What is the bull for, you sacrificial geniuses? The bull for the sin offering. Who is that for? Aaron. Okay? That is for him. Okay? Before he goes and atones for the people's sin, i.e., the sin offering, what does he first have to do? Yeah, your high priest has to get right with God and offer an offering to God, okay? Verse 4, this is interesting. Read this.
He shall put on the holy linen coat and shall have the linen undergarment on his body, and he shall tie the linen sash around his waist and wear the linen turban. These are the holy garments.
Okay, this is what he's going to wear that day, okay? Now, this should, though we didn't cover it in great detail, go, this is weird. What's weird about verse 4? Yeah, it's not as much stuff. You guys remember the garb with the big ornate hat and the breastplate with all the jewels on it and the shoulder. I mean, it's elaborate. We got a whole chapter on it in Exodus. What is this? You're putting on a white bathrobe with a white sash to tie it. Simple. What does linen communicate? It's communicated today.
Comfort.
Clean. Comfort, right? Mostly clean. White. Why white? Clean. Okay? So most days when Aaron would go into the holy, not the Holy of Holies, that's not most days, that's once a year. Okay? Most times when he's in the tabernacle, where then is the focus? In turning the outfit, in terms of the outfit. There's some focus on Aaron, right? What is God saying by Aaron? Bathrobe and a sash. White. focuses all on God, okay? So Aaron, you're just another kind of cog in the wheel. You're important, but you're not going to, this isn't an elaborate day about you. Simple and clean, the focus is on me, okay? Bathe first, put on your new clothes, okay? Verse 5. Yeah. They would have had, they don't have land, but they certainly have stuff that would have been given to them or through the community. So it was probably provided by those around them, and they would have had, yeah, so somehow from the community. Okay. Verse 5.
And he shall take from the congregation of the people of Israel 2 male goats for a sin offering and 1 ram for a burnt offering.
Okay, now we've got 2 male goats for a sin offering, okay, and a ram for a burnt offering, okay? Verse 6, we see the sin offering is for himself, okay, that he may make atonement for himself and his household, which we saw, and then he's going to make one for the people. Verse 7, he shall take 2 goats and present them before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting, okay? Verse 8, read that.
And Aaron shall cast lots over the 2 goats, 1 lot for the goat and the other lot for Azazel. And Aaron shall present the goat on which the lot fell for the Lord and use it as a sin offering.
Now, this is a different picture. We've never seen this, okay? We have now 2 male goats, okay? My translation says one for the Lord and the other for the scapegoat, or Azazel, okay? That's the literal word. It comes from the Hebrew word, which means goat and depart is probably the best translation. We don't know exactly what it means, but that's the idea. So there's some idea of to remove and goat, okay? So you've got one goat that's going to be the lot for the Lord. What does that mean? What have we seen with all these other animals that we've read about? What happens to them? They're sacrificed. So there's one that's for the Lord. It's going to die. It's going to be placed on the altar and killed. And then there's one that is a scapegoat. Different picture, okay? So again, remember Jews, everything is about pictures. Everything is about imagery. Why is God doing this? One time a year, one person goes into the Holy of Holies, okay, and atones for the nation's sin, okay? And by the way, this is the idea that, listen, you got to get out of jail free card for a year. But after you've looked at all these chapters, do you think there's sins that happened that no one knew about, that just stacked up with millions of people? The idea is God saying, I can handle that for so long, but even within this nation, you guys have defiled yourself, not even knowing it, even if you're walking with me, and you're still blowing it. So we have to provide an offering that covers all of the sins, even the ones that you don't know about, and probably for some that they did, that they didn't atone for, or what have you, okay? So two animals now are there, okay? One for the Lord, and then a scapegoat, okay? Verse 9, Aaron shall offer the goat on which the lot fell for the Lord and make it a sin offering, okay? We've seen that. It's going to be offered as a sin offering for all the sins of the people, okay? We've seen that before. It is a sexy beast, apparently, okay? So these goats were identical, same size, same value, okay? They looked very, very similar in terms of, you know, what would have been offered, okay? But verse 10, read that. We have never seen this before. What happens to this goat? It's left alive. What kind of offering is that? That doesn't fit with the system at all, right? Take your goat, you slay it. That's the, you know, it has to be blood sacrifice. So one goat is going to be for the Lord, sacrificed, and the other goat, what? What happens?
Sent away from the people.
Okay, let's keep going. Let's figure out what this means, okay? 11, 12, we read some of this stuff before. Aaron's going to offer the bull for the offering for himself, slaughter it. Verse 12, he's going to take a fire pan full of coals on the fire and the altar before the Lord, 2 handfuls of finely ground sweet incense, and bring it inside the veil. How do you think Aaron, by the way, is feeling right now? What just happened? His 2 sons died. How? Doing verse 12. Taking a fire pan full of coals, putting it on the altar, handfuls of finely ground sweet incense, and bringing it inside the veil, right? They offered unauthorized fire on the altar. They screwed up something in this exact same process, right? So how do you think Aaron's going about this? What do you think the people are doing? I mean, they are nail-biting. They are like, look, we've only done this once, and it didn't end well. Two sons died, and now Aaron said, or God says to Aaron, get up, let's go, we're doing it again, okay? Now, he's going inside the veil, and he's not inside the Holy of Holies yet, but he's doing the exact same actions that his sons just did that died. He's probably wigging out, right? I mean, internally you're thinking, boy, I hope I put enough cinnamon in. I hope I didn't screw that up, okay? And I hope that you've got to sense the fear in him and just the tenseness of the situation, right? Okay? He shall put the incense, verse 13, before the fire, the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the ark of the testimony, otherwise he will die. Okay? Part of what this aroma and this concoction of ingredients would have done was literally create a cloud. You guys have seen beekeepers when they go to deal with bees and they spray the whatever it is to kind of calm the bees down. Think that. Okay? So he's going in with this very fragrant offering that he's going to bring in on the fire pan before the Lord, and it's going to create this smoky smell. Okay? And the idea is you're kind of covering, hiding God, if you will, so that you can interact with him. Okay? So that you don't see even all of them lest you die. All of him. Okay? So, 15. Let's keep going there. Or I'm sorry, 14. He's going to put blood on the mercy seat. This is inside now the altar. This is on top of the ark, the golden mercy seat that stood on the very top of the ark. It's contained now Aaron's rod, the budded manna that we'll see, or the manna that God's going to provide for them in the wilderness, and then ultimately right now the law, okay, that is inside that. Okay, he puts blood on that to clean it as well. Okay, 15. Okay, so again, now the offering for the people, the one that was chosen for the Lord is killed. Blood goes on the altar. He's cleaning the altar. He's making everything right with this idea of shedding of blood. Okay, and the rest of 16, 17, 18 is more about what they're doing with the offerings, how they're taking these now sin offerings. Okay, 21, here's the other goat. One for the Lord, one for Azazel or the scapegoat. Read 21.
Shall put them on the head of the goat and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of man who is in readiness.
Okay, so 21, talk to me. What's going on? What is Aaron doing?
Well, that's a similar picture to the rest of the people that pray their sins onto the animals before they bring it to the priest for sacrifice. So he's praying the sins of the people onto this goat.
Good. Okay. So, how many people is Aaron praying the sins onto this goat? All, right? 2 to 3 million people. Probably took a little bit. Would you get, right? It's not, you know, now obviously he's not going like by list and has, you know, it's not like Santa Claus, right? But he's praying the sins of the entire nation of Israel onto this goat. And what is the entire nation of Israel doing right now? Watching Aaron do this, right? And he's had now a goat killed. They've seen him come in and out, right, of the altar to a degree. They can't go inside, but they know he's still moving. History tells us that they would even tie a bell on the high priest's leg to make sure that there was still movement so they could hear him because they couldn't go in there, or a string even that if he were to have a heart attack in the midst of it, they could pull him out with not having to go in. There's some crazy stuff that they did with the high priest, some of which we won't get into, but it's nuts, okay? So they're hearing this going on. It's quiet. It's somber. They're thinking about their sin. There is the goat that Moses or Aaron has offered for our sin, and now there's a second goat. All of our sin is being placed upon that goat, right? That's the imagery. That's what we've seen. We're transferring our sin onto this goat, okay? Again, new picture. Why is this here, okay? All of it is communicated onto this goat, and then what do they do with this goat, verse 22? Okay, so Israel sees this Azazel, this scapegoat. They confess all of their sins on it. And there's some man who stands in readiness, okay, who takes this goat in the wilderness to some solitary place, and what do they do with it? They let it go, okay? History also tells us when we're talking about wilderness, right, we're not in Hume Lake, we're in the desert, okay? And there are huge cliffs and mountains, okay? If you just confessed all of your sin unto this goat, okay, and all of Israel's sins here, and you just were like, go free, fluffy, right? How would you feel as an Israelite when that goat comes wandering back into the camp a couple days later? Not real good, okay? So if you wanted to make real good and sure that that goat didn't come back in, what would you do? Bye-bye, fluffy, right off the cliff, right? And history tells us that that's probably what happened. They would shove it off a cliff to make sure that it died, okay? So, now again.
So they did want it to die. I'm confused by, like, the lack of bloodshed.
Why is that there? Okay, let's answer that question, okay? Why would God feel it necessary to answer another question or to present another image? What did the sin offering do for Israel that was offered by Aaron during this day? It covered their sin, right? Yom Kippur, day of covering. Shed blood atones for sin. Did the first animal do that? Yes, okay? It's complete. It's an okay offering. It's done exactly according to the law. Why do we need the second goat? Why did Israel need to see not just their sin paid for, but their sin put upon another animal and then removed? It's where? Where is their sin? Is it in the camp? Where is it? It's gone. What's the picture? Not yet. Don't go to Jesus yet. What's the picture for Israel? The removal of sin. What did I do with your sin? I took it away. It's not just like hocus pocus atoned for. It's gone. That's the picture. That's why that's important. Okay? So it's interesting to me that God would feel it necessary to add this piece to their system. So do you then carry guilt because of your sin? No. Why? It's gone. Gone according to who? God. He doesn't see you as sinful. He sees that sin is removed. It's paid for. It's atoned by the blood of another, and the guilt and any baggage or junk that you may carry with it is gone. You don't need to hang on to it. You don't need to whip yourself with a whatever or bury yourself in false guilt because you sin. It's removed, right? You guys see the picture? Do you see how you cannot possibly understand the cross without understanding the pictures that God has given to Israel? What happened on the cross? Turn to Romans 8, verse 3. How is Jesus described by Paul?
Mm-hmm. For God has done what the law, weakened by the flesh, could not do.
What does that mean, real quick? What's the problem with this system? They're going to sin again. So what's the problem with the law? How long did this sacrifice work? For a year. Well, for a minute, right? But it was basically I'll tolerate you for another year. Okay, I can deal with your sin until we get to Tishri 1, Rosh Hashanah starts, and then Yom Kippur on the 10th. I can deal with you for that long. But what do we have to do again? Over and over and over. God's like, this is a broken system. Can the law ultimately deal with your sin? No, because your high priest is jacked, right? He's got to present a burnt offering for himself before he can even start. The system is broken in that it has to repeat itself. So as you're a Jew, you're thinking, when will this end? When will we have a sacrifice that's good enough to end this perpetual, you know, hamster wheel that we're on, okay? So the law could not do because it was weak in the flesh. So keep going.
By sending his own son in the likeness of sinful flesh and for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh, in order that the righteous requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us.
So what is the picture painted of what Jesus is? What is he then according to 8:3? He's a scapegoat. He's a sin offering. Okay, so that's a piece of it. So this is more the kind of first goat picture. Okay, likeness of sinful flesh as an offering for sin. Okay, he is a sin offering. Now, 2 Corinthians 5, 21. Verse 20, start there.
Therefore we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. We implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God.
All right, be reconciled to God. Here is how you be reconciled with God. 21.
For our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God.
Okay, now I don't want, again, this is a picture. Paul is thinking about something as he writes this. He made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf. He, God, made Jesus who knew no sin, okay, to be sin on our behalf. Anybody in your text, if you've got an NASB, you see those words to be? You see how they're in italics? What does that mean? It means in the original language, they're not there. Okay, this is how this is supposed to read. He made him who knew no sin, sin on our behalf. What is the picture? He made him who knew no sin, sin on our behalf. What is he saying? He's the scapegoat. He put the sin, all of the sin, on Jesus. He became sin on our behalf. That's the picture that Paul is painting. He's thinking in his head, I'm guessing, you can ask him when we get there, Leviticus chapter 16. So, did he pay for our sin with the cross? Yes, and died. What else did he do according to this? He became that sin on our behalf. That agony, how do you think that goat felt? I mean, if you could imagine. That is a goat loaded with a lot of sin. Why did Jesus agonize in the Garden of Gethsemane? How did he feel? It's not that he was just going to the cross to die.
The sins of the people were on him and he was going to bear the wrath of God.
What does that weight feel like? All of the sins of humanity forever infused in you. This isn't like hypothetical. This is, God is saying, I am putting this on you, and you're going to bear that to the point where you're going to sweat blood because of the agony that comes with that. I mean, is that not a powerful picture of our sacrificial lamb and our scapegoat? That's ultimately what Paul is communicating for Jesus. So when a Jew would see this picture of Jesus, who better to understand the imagery than one that would say, I saw that. Every year, I watched Aaron walk into the tabernacle or the temple, whatever it was at that point in time, and make atonement for my sin. I saw that picture. And Jesus says, I'm done. I'm it. The book of Hebrews talks about that. I am the final high priest. I'm better than Aaron. My system is better. I died once for all for the sins of all of humanity forever. And we need not ever do that again. Okay? So, powerful, powerful picture. Okay? So, if you were to paint Leviticus like a mountain, okay, what is at the top of that mountain? Chapter 16, the Day of Atonement. Okay, that is the climax of the book of Leviticus. So what has the author tried to do now for 15 chapters before you got there? You are a sinner. You are in need. You've broken food laws or menstruation laws or this law or that law, and you've been offering sacrifice. You're convinced, just like Paul, Romans 1 through 3, you are a sinner. You have screwed up, right? The whole first part of Romans is you've broken the law somewhere. So until chapter 3, I'm trying to convince you that you need a Savior. That's all Leviticus is. You need help. You cannot do it on your own. And then 16 presents the solution. And down from there, we're going to see the rest of the book unfold. That is the results of that and more of kind of the same that we've looked at. Okay? So this is, without a doubt, one of the most important pictures in your Old Testament. Okay? Our guide, Ronan, okay, his youngest son's name is Itamar. Okay? Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Itamar. Okay? Every Jew, when they're born, has what they call a Torah portion. They give you, on your birth, a scripture, a chapter of the Torah, of the law, that is yours. Okay? His son's Torah portion was Leviticus chapter 16. Okay? That happened to be the reading for that day, and that is your text. Okay? So often what will happen is, you either name your kids some whatever name that you want to, or you pick a name from someone in the story in chapter 16. And because of Aaron's sons participating in that, that is why Ronan named his firstborn kid Itamar. Okay, so there's a special connection there. Okay, this picture is important. Okay, and of all the ways you look at how we're to interact with God throughout history, this picture, I think, is key to our understanding of Him, especially through our New Testament lenses and the understanding now we have of the extent to which Christ went and what He did. Okay, so there's a beautiful lesson in this too, I think, even with practically for you and I and for our sin. Okay, when we sin, is that sin paid for? Yes. Okay. How are we supposed to feel about that afterwards? Where else? What else happened to that sin? It's removed. So the guilt that would go with that, that false guilt that says, you're no good, you're a piece of dirt, right? God doesn't love you. No, that sin is gone, and God sees it as gone, as much as the people are supposed to. Okay, so it should change the way we interact with God, even in our failings, to get up and say, Lord, I know I'm going to fall again. I know I'm going to blow it, but you paid for my sin. You removed my sin. You removed the guilt of my sin. That stuff that I feel is not from you. That is false guilt. That is not right. I need to confess. I need to be contrite. I need to be aware of my sin. And when I blow it, I need to confess, and that's good. But anything that happens after that point when you've said, Lord, ugh, there it is, that comes, any baggage that comes after that is not from the Lord, because He's saying, it's done. I see you as clean forever. Okay? So, cool? Questions or thoughts on that?
Because of that system and how serious it is, must be the exact reason why when Jesus comes on the scene and says, I'm going to take away the sins of the world, why the Jews were so angry about that?
Why would that language be so important? Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the Lord. What did Yom Kippur did? Day of covering. Covered the sin. What's unique about what Jesus did? Took it away, right? The scapegoat's a picture of that, but He took it away for a year. It's temporary. That sin was covered. The mercy seat, that's what it is. You're covering the broken law with the shed blood of an animal. So as God looks through at the broken law of Israel, He sees a covering. Perfect gold, blood that atoned for that, but it only lasts a year. Jesus is saying, I didn't just cover it. I removed it. I took it away. It's gone. Okay, and that's what Israel would have felt to a degree in a broken system. I don't think so. I think that's a hard issue of saying, look, you've got a believer that's acting like an unbeliever and they don't want to repent. So if they want to act like an unbeliever, treat them like an unbeliever. Remove them from your midst. Right. Maybe. I think it's more of the, look, you're taking the death of Christ very lightly and you don't care and your heart is hard. So to get your heart right, we're going to bring consequences that hopefully will wake you up to the reality of what you're doing. So if you're not going to repent of your sin and you're not going to care, you're acting like an unbeliever. So we're going to take steps to remedy that. The final step, which is you're gone. You're out of fellowship. You don't get to come to church. You don't get to interact with believers. You get to act like an unbeliever. And we're going to love you, you know, in our context, until you, we want you to come back. But yeah, so that's why Paul's saying, yeah, it's remove them. You know, if they don't see the seriousness of this, it's not a direct connection. So, Tomas.
Is being unclean always the same as sinning? Because, I mean, obviously, like, having a kid doesn't seem like a sin.
Yeah, clearly not, right? So I don't think so. Maybe some of the repercussions were the same and that you were ousted for a season, but yeah, it's not. Yeah, you can't look at childbirth and say, well, that's wrong or sinful. So no, it just would, you would need a way to have fellowship with God again. But some it's heart level and some of it's just reality of life. So yeah, you bump up against a dead animal, it's like, well, man, that was accidental. I didn't have malice in my heart. So yeah, there's some distinction there for sure.
Yeah. With a lot of that.
It seems based on the Acts text that God said, man, the law's over. Okay, Peter, arise and eat. Here's the sheet full of stuff you never eat before. Peter's like, I ain't touching that. God says, no, it's green light now. So Christ came to fulfill the law, not to abolish it, but to fulfill it. Now, there are portions of it that we still obviously do, like don't murder. Well, that's a good idea, right? Let's not do that, right? We don't do it because the law tells us to. We do it because in following Christ, that's the right thing to do. So the law, in a sense, has been, there's a higher law on following Christ, okay? Jews will get bent out of shape when we say that Jesus came to abolish the law. He didn't come to abolish it. He came to fulfill it. He lived it out in such a way that we are now freed from having to follow the law. We're free to follow the one that followed the law, if that makes sense. So yeah, those are all, we're good.
Is a lot of it like kind of under your own discretion?
Yeah. And that's the beauty and the difficulty of the New Testament. Well, can I listen to Metallica? I don't know. Can I? Does it lead me to sin? Maybe it does. Well, maybe for someone else it doesn't. Then by all means, listen to it. It's a peripheral issue. There's no law on that. It's walk with God. Make good decisions. Be morally discerning, right?
Like, I was on that channel every time, and he called it like a diagnostic and a cure. And saying that the law is like the MRI scan for like cancer, showing that you're sinful and you have a problem.
Yep.
Gospel is the fix for that.
It's a great way to look at it. So. And that's what Paul's going to say in Romans. Man, I didn't know I was sinning until I hit the law. And I was like, oh, hello. Well, you know, I didn't know I was sinning driving home from Texas until I saw the speed limit sign. I was like, oh, I guess I should slow down because I'm doing 75 and 55. But I didn't know until then, right? That's the law. It doesn't fix it. It just tells you, Mike, idiot. Oh, well, right? But there's not a cure for that in the law. That's exactly right. That's a great way to look at it. Jesus was the solution to that problem. So, keep this mental picture fresh, guys. This is a powerful, powerful picture. And God did this again with great purpose. He took an entire book, and he's going to paint the front half and the back half to this conclusion that's in the middle to say, this is the pinnacle, and I want you to see this picture. And it's not just for Jews. This is for us. This is a, again, it's just another facet of turning the diamond of our Savior and seeing him now from another angle and go, wow, that's amazing, right? And then to see Paul begin to paint some of those pictures to say, as a Jew, I understood that. He is our sin offering, and he is our scapegoat, okay? So, cool? Let me pray for us, and we'll be done. God, thanks for today. Thank you for these pictures in the Old Testament. God, I'm grateful for a guy with a very simple mind like mine that pictures just make a lot of sense, that you would have been so good to pen these for us, that you would have Moses sit and write these, that we would, as American Christians thousands of years after this have a glimpse into the depths of our Savior and what the nation of Israel went through and how we get to see through them a complete and full picture of Christ. So God, thank you for Israel. Thank you that we stand on their shoulders. Thank you for the salvation that is now ours because you were so good to offer it to us. And God, may we never forget that the old is not old. The old is good for us to see and to know and to read these pages because the images of our Savior leap off the page and help communicate for us what it means to have a sin offering, in a scapegoat, and that our sin, God, before you is gone. It is removed. We can walk in holiness and blamelessness before you, and God, be a people that whose sin was atoned for once and for all, and not just atoned and covered, but God, removed. So thank you for our Savior, our hero, Christ, and thank you for God loving him and loving us enough to put the weight of the world's sin upon him, that we could have right fellowship and interaction with you. We love you. In Christ's name, amen. All right. Cool.